Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming out on a very cold night. I'll start in about a minute. Anne, are we ready to go?
Anytime
I'm ready. Okay. Thanks for coming along tonight. Elizabeth Broderick makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. She was only here about 6 months ago talking on the issue of female representation on boards, but a different topic tonight. So I'll introduce Elizabeth Broderick very briefly. She qualified in law and practiced in a number of jobs in the legal profession, but from 2007 she was appointed Sex Discrimination Commissioner, and that includes a responsibility for AIDS discrimination. So Ms. Broderick is Sex Discrimination Commissioner, also responsible for AIDS discrimination, and she's going to talk to us tonight on reflections on AIDS discrimination, the price we pay for growing older. Elizabeth Broderick, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thanks, Jared, and it's really terrific to be back here at the Sydney Institute. Thanks very much to Anne for arranging it. I thought for a minute, Jared, you were going to ask young people to come to the front and older ones at the back, and I thought, oh no, age discrimination, we can't have that. But no. So it's really great to be back here today. Now, if I kind of halfway through the speech fall over, I've got a little bit of cord running here, so you might have to come back, to come down and resuscitate me. I'll put it there. But I come here today to talk to you at the end of my term as the Commissioner responsible for age discrimination. And let me start by acknowledging that we are meeting here today on the traditional lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and to pay my respects to their elders both past and present. My path to promote age equality over the last 3 years has been both sobering but also incredibly uplifting. Sobering to expose what I've often referred to as invisible discrimination in our society. A discrimination so widely and unconsciously accepted that we're often completely unaware that our actions support it. And then uplifting because there's so much momentum for change. And of course, one manifestation of that momentum, and the reason that we're meeting here this evening, is that for the first time, as from next month, as from July, we will have a full-time age discrimination commissioner. And I think I see a number of representatives from peak bodies in the audience. It's something peak bodies have advocated for many months, for many years actually. It's something that we've been committed to. And I think it's an opportunity for the sector to celebrate. Because this means that, like all the other areas of discrimination, like race, like disability, like Indigenous, we will finally have a fully funded commissioner together with a small team of people, but with the ability to devote their time, their advocacy, and the resource to this important area of combating age discrimination. There are many critical issues facing older people, ranging from issues such as aged care, age discrimination, but right through to the issue of elder abuse. But before I start, I want to share with you a story that really highlights what it is that I'll be focusing on tonight. And it's representative of quite a number of stories and complaints that we actually get into the Australian Human Rights Commission. We recently had a 50-year-old man come to the commission to complain that he'd applied for a job for which he considered he was well qualified, well experienced. He was told several weeks later that he wouldn't be considered for the position as he didn't have enough industry experience. So you can imagine his surprise when a few days later he was accidentally forwarded an email which was meant for the recruitment consultant, which referring to his application said, "Sounds good, but I think a bit old. Need to get back to him with a result though." So needless to say, that matter settled. But it's issues like those that we see quite regularly. And that's the area I want to focus on tonight. I want to focus on the area of older people and age discrimination, particularly in the area of paid work. So I want to do four things this evening. Firstly, I'm going to make some introductory remarks about age discrimination and ageism more generally in Australian society. Secondly, I will reflect on my time in the role and some of the people I've met and their stories. Thirdly, I want to look at what's changed over the term, and there has been significant change. And then finally, I want to make some comments about the future, particularly in relation to this global push for a convention on the rights of older people. The fact is, we do live in an ageist society, a society where the better health and life expectancies of people are often perversely cast as a burden. So it seems perfectly innocent when we talk about Gen Ys, baby boomers, we attribute certain behaviour, abilities and characteristics to them, selfish go-getters, grumpy technophobes. We feel it perfectly benign that our society categorises people in this way, and we use these terms in our day-to-day lives, particularly when we look at the media. But the reality is that by embracing these terms and the host of meanings that underlie these terms, those meanings start to become true to us, and we start to apply unsubstantiated and incorrect generalisations to the way we behave toward people. We attach stereotypical views to diverse groups based purely on their age. Oh, you're someone of that age, therefore you must be. And I think when you look at those stereotypes and you apply them in the recruitment and employment area, they can have devastating impact. And if you doubt this reality, let me tell you about another of the people that I've heard from during my term as commissioner responsible for age discrimination. And this is just one of a myriad of stories that I've heard over the last 3 years. But he was a very experienced and highly skilled man, aged in his 40s. He was from the film industry, and he'd been out of work since January because of a downturn in production. He couldn't access any Centrelink payments because, fortunately, he did have some savings from which he was living, but which were now rapidly diminishing. And finding he was not only being passed over by recruitment companies when he submitted his CV, but was not even having his applications acknowledged, he began to make some inquiries. And the responses he received were, at the very least, quite surprising. He was told by more than one agency that the highest priority was to get younger people into the workforce first, because it was that companies were only looking for younger, more dynamic staff who would fit in well with their young teams. And he was further told, and the research very much supports this, this is a stereotype, that older people are seen largely to be less compliant, more opinionated, tended to fight management over issues, and often tried to force their own morals, virtues and views of life onto others. Discriminatory, I ask you? We hear a lot about the ageing population. I'm sure you're across some of the statistics, but globally, the statistics show that in 2009, 11% of people were aged 60 years and over, 11%. By 2050, that will be 22%, so we'll have a doubling. That is 2 billion people over the age of 60 by 2050, by which time older people will outnumber children. And if I bring that back here to Australia, and we've got the 2007 data, 13% of the population in 2007 was 65 and over, and by 2056 that will double to 23%, or almost double. So exposing, stigmatising and eradicating unlawful age discrimination is important, firstly because it's wrong, and secondly because every single one of us, now and into the future, stands the chance of facing this form of discrimination as we grow older. So it is the great leveller. So my main point today is that the demographic shift to an ageing population has already happened. It's here, it's our certain future. As a nation, what we now need to do is we need to stride into this certain future with policies and attitudes that firstly identify it, that secondly name it, and thirdly that halt this form of discrimination. So if I can now just move into my second area and just to reflect a little bit about my time in the role. It's been such a great privilege to have worked as the Commissioner responsible for age discrimination over the last 3 years. Just the range of people, the stories, it's been a wonderful privilege. But I'll never forget the first light bulb moment I had when the reality of age discrimination really started to hit me. And it was probably at one of my first briefings at the Australian Human Rights Commission. I was a new commissioner on board. And I remember I was sitting there concentrating studiously, as you do when you're in your new job, when the presenter started talking about who exactly a mature age worker was. Mature age workers are workers aged 45 years and older, she stated, as she moved pragmatically to her next point. I remember thinking, what? 45 and over? That can't be right. That's me. I'm a mature age worker, but I'm only 47. Which was when I realised that this was the great untold story about ageism and age discrimination in our country. That once you turn 45, in employment terms, you're considered by many in the employment market to be over the hill. And the further over the hill you get, the more unemployable you're likely to become. Not because you're unskilled, simply because the prevailing community attitude and dominant set of stereotypes have moved to now consider you to be old, and with this, saddled with those host of destructive and often false assumptions. And the thing that really got me about age discrimination was that it wasn't someone else's, someone older's issue anymore. Here I was at 47, a mature age worker, where this issue was squarely my issue. And I realised that what I had to do was to work with others to make them see it too. So I resolved to get the real picture by seeking out the experiences and the stories of people who were living with age discrimination and its impacts. And among other things, I embarked on a period of consultation, and I spoke to quite a number of you in this room. I spoke to peak bodies in the age sector, legal service providers, unions, business, academics, relevant government departments, and of course older people themselves. And with the aid of my small team, I amassed as much knowledge and research as I could. And then one blustery Victorian day in August 2009, I presented what I knew and what I now feared in a speech at the Australian Institute of Family Studies in Melbourne. And my speech was entitled, Mature Age Worker, You'll Be One Sooner Than You Think. Now, I have to say that the result was both immediate and in excess of my expectations. I hadn't appreciated the deep vein of community concern that this issue brings. We'd hit our target. The media started calling. We had producers, journalists and presenters being in the field of media who had actually lived through what we were talking about. And, of course, there were others who were just happy to have the experiences they were living with finally named. I heard from women whose skilled husbands had fallen into clinical depression after repeated recruitment rejections. I remember a man in his early 50s who had applied for over 500 positions in 8 years and had received just 4 interviews. A woman in her late 50s who was told that her job no longer existed, therefore she was going to be made redundant, only to find that someone else in their early 30s was then hired to do exactly the same work under a different position name. People who'd been subjected to ageist taunts and jokes in a bid to force them into early retirement, often having it suggested that they have a responsibility to make way for someone younger. People being asked questions in interviews such as, why do you want this job at this late stage of your life? How long do you really intend to keep working? How do you think you'll keep up with our younger staff? Or, actually, our team's a bit younger. Do you think you'll be able to fit in? Is this the price we pay for growing older? I was confronted by the sense of shame that often accompanies this form of discrimination, the stripping away of dignity, the fact that after you have been rejected time and time again, some people begin to internalise, believe and even accept the stereotype themselves, and that leads to them ultimately self-selecting out of the workforce. And I think for me, I became acutely aware that a person's work can define their sense of self-respect and their individual identity. It reinforced to me that discrimination should not be the thing that determines a person's choice to work or not work. Because that's what we're really talking about here. We're talking about choice. Now, I'm not for a minute suggesting that everyone over the age of 60 or 45, for that matter, should be in paid work if they choose not to. But what I'm saying is that their choice should be a genuine one. The tragic and quite honestly insulting fact is that many people do want to keep working. In fact, not only do want to, they need to keep working. But for reasons that have nothing to do with skill, ability, capacity or merit, people who want to work are unable to do so. And the repercussions are significant. The very common outcome, and it's an outcome that I imagine a significant proportion of people never expected, is poverty in older age. In fact, at an age that's not that old at all. And if you doubt that, let me share you some of the statistics with you. In 2009, so just 2 years ago, the OECD reported that more than one in four older people in Australia were living in poverty. One in four. And Australia had the fourth highest old age poverty rate amongst OECD countries, a rate that was double the OECD average. So this dreamy image of two glamorous, well-funded retirees dressed in breezy blue and white country road, throwing the stick for their golden retriever as they walk down the beach, is just that. It's a dream. But if it all sounds a bit woeful, I want to assure you that there is cause for great hope, and we've seen significant progress in recent years. And I want to turn now to my third area of discussion and to really outline some of those changes. In that initial speech to the Australian Institute of Family Studies, I called for four key areas of reform. The first thing was that we needed to strengthen the Age Discrimination Act. It was a poor relation in terms of anti-discrimination law in this country. Second thing, we needed to audit the federal laws that contained age limits and ask, is that age limit still applicable? Workers' compensation, superannuation. The third thing we needed to do is we needed more research. There was a dearth of research in this area. And fourthly, we needed a well-funded awareness-raising strategy which was built from a strong evidence base. And I had compelling reasons to call for those four reforms. I mean, if you look at the Act, despite the Age Discrimination Act being the most recent Act, and an important source of rights protection, it's widely considered to be the weakest. It contained a more difficult discrimination test. It had the broadest range of exemptions, and it didn't set up the office of a commissioner. At the same time, we were hearing from people that age-based restrictions in federal laws were stopping them doing things in paid work, and that things like age caps in superannuation workers' compensation, those things needed to change, hence the call for an audit of laws. And the dire lack of research in this area, I think, is a reflection of the extent to which age discrimination is way behind the eight ball compared with other areas of discrimination for which there is proper and comprehensive evidence bases. And therefore, it goes without saying that a funded communication strategies to raise both awareness about the forms of age discrimination and really expose this deeply entrenched ageism was also going to be very important. So if I look back over my 3 years, what are the things that have changed in response to these four challenges? And they are mainly in the law reform area and also in the policy area. Because in 2008... the Australian government began a number of important policy changes, and I want to briefly outline six of them here. In relation to the Age Discrimination Act, there was really a positive development. The government decided to remove what they call the dominant reason test, which is the more difficult test for establishing age discrimination. And its removal brought that act into line with the tests contained in the three other federal acts. So that was a positive first positive step. The second positive step, as we've been talking about, is that as of yesterday, the bill received royal assent, a bill that set up the Office of a Full-Time Age Discrimination Commissioner. Lucky we're holding it today, Jared, not the day before yesterday, because I might have been able to say that. Number three, in relation to the exemptions, the federal government has launched Australia's Human Rights Framework, which recommends combining all federal anti-discrimination laws into a single act. And one of the potentials of that process is it offers the potential to examine the broad exemptions under the Age Discrimination Act. And really to take that act from being the poor relation to finally an equal partner in terms of the protection that's offered, and particularly the protection offered to older people. But just as law reform is critical, so too are initiatives at the policy level. So the fourth thing that the government's done is in 2010, off the back of the third intergenerational report, the Treasurer announced a package, what they called the Productive Ageing Package, which was a package of initiatives of $43 million. But most importantly, they set up what they called a consultative forum. Now, it's the first body of this kind, which is to provide advice to government on practical solutions to address barriers to employment of older people, and particularly to focus on age discrimination. So I'm really excited about this, because the focus up until now has been on, oh, we need to give people greater skills, greater training. No, that is important. I'm not saying it's not. But just doing that is not enough. We need to combat age discrimination, which sits above whether or not you've got the right skills or training. It's that set of attitudes that we've talked about. So that's been a very positive development. The fifth initiative is a charter that Australian employers have been asked to sign and to stand up against age discrimination, and some of our largest companies have signed on to that. And the government and others will then assist them with strategies on the retention of mature age people. So that's been a good initiative. And the final sixth initiative that I want to talk about is the establishment of an advisory panel on the economic potential of senior Australians. So this is about turning it round and recognising actually older people represent opportunity for our country, and to look at ways this opportunity can be actually brought into a lot of the policy decisions. I've also seen positive change at the parliamentary level, the state level, and a bipartisan approach to this area, which you don't often see. So that's been a really positive development. And then in the research area, I can report a significant increase in the number of Australian research partnerships and proposals on age discrimination, ageism and ageing more generally. When I first came in, to try and find academics who were working in this area was very, very difficult. That's absolutely changed. And the most important thing is that the Australian government has commissioned a full prevalence study. So to look at the nature and extent of age discrimination. And with that data, we'll be able to start building some evidence-based education programs on the top of that. Here at the Australian Human Rights Commission, we released a first education resource on age discrimination. That was late last year. And that publication looks at everything from the definition of ageism and a summary of the legal protections, case studies, and really putting the human face on this issue. And we have got some of the copies of that paper outside. So while it is early days, I am optimistic that long-term research dollars will continue to be directed towards age discrimination. That's what we need. And by any assessment, I think these changes represent significant progress in an emerging policy area which many people had not even heard of 3 years ago. So which brings me really to the final thing I said I'd talk about, and that is about the future. Internationally, there's been a courageous push towards establishing a binding international convention on the rights of older people. Now, this is not to give older people additional rights. It's to recognise that older people have not the opportunity to enjoy their rights to the same extent as others, and to start to put some structure around that. So a binding convention will recognise the fundamental human rights and freedoms of older people globally. And we're here in Australia and other first world countries, you hear stories of elder abuse and deprivation of liberty. But when I speak to my counterparts in the developing world, in advocates there, they remind me that the situation for many older people, particularly people living in countries with no age pension, that the situation is particularly dire. So a convention will open up the space for the voices of older people to be heard, and for older people themselves to be the architects of their own destiny. And in terms of raising community awareness, the push for an international convention represents a really important advocacy tool for NGOs, so for the peak bodies, for activists, but also for government in providing a useful domestic whole of government policy framework. So I think it's an exciting and important time at the minute to start to have conversations about an international convention, and those conversations need to broaden out from the Human Rights Commission and the peak bodies. They need to be taken out to the wider community. Concerns about age discrimination should form part of our national conversation in our newspapers, our radios, TVs, as well as in our everyday conversations. Because I'm talking here about building a social movement. For me, it's a social movement similar to the one that led to heightened awareness of areas such as sex discrimination, women's rights in the gender area. With this more visible conversation and about age discrimination comes inevitability, and that is the inevitability of change. And if we can create a focus, galvanise people to action, it's not just some far-flung international phenomenon. It's actually happening right here in our own backyard. And in particular, I do want to note the wonderful efforts of organisations like Council of the Ageing National, National Seniors Australia, our two really terrific peak bodies, and the age sector generally, who are starting to take these discussions around the convention and continuing to advocate for the rights of older people. Both government and business have taken important steps. It's often in our workplaces that that changes in social attitude begin, and then we can take them out to the wider community. And it's my sincere hope that business, government and the community sector will continue to work together to actually do just that. To the human rights sector, of which I'm a part, I say that age discrimination is all our business. To fight one form of discrimination is to fight them all. Many forms of discrimination involve older people. It's not just age. We have older women, we have older people with disability, we have our Indigenous sisters, we have older people who are culturally and linguistically diverse, and of course we have older people of different sexualities. We need to understand the diversity of older people, and we need to act on the multiple forms of discrimination that they may experience. And finally tonight, to older people themselves, for some of you I know, I won't have said anything tonight that you didn't already know. For others, maybe I just simply named that which you felt deeply but accepted as something that you have to live with. No one needs to put or should put up with age discrimination. The challenge of a deeply entrenched and accepted form of discrimination is to stigmatise it, to speak up in our circles of influence and to name it, to say clearly that it is unacceptable. This is wrong. This goes against everything our community and our culture stands for. And I'm really grateful to my own father, who's done just that in our own family. He now good-naturedly points out the times when we use language that might be excluding of older people, or when we blithely propose some age-based stereotype without thinking. He says, "Where's the evidence for that?" So this is a social movement that we now must strive for, the kind of movement that we've seen in other areas such as gender, such as disability and race, led by the voices of older people, This is the foundation needed for a community that is truly inclusive. A community that when we speak about human rights, age equality is front and centre. Thank you very much.
You stay there, you'll be fine. So many thanks, Elizabeth Broderick. Thanks to Mellisons for the use of this facility. Our speaker's gone exactly 30 minutes, so we've got up until no later than 7 o'clock to finish off. Can I just lead off? You've spoken a bit about, very good speech, but you've spoken a bit about, in a way, regulation as the solution to some of these problems. But to what extent is regulation part of the problem? If you take, some of your case studies are from larger companies at the front of your speech, but if you take, say, a smaller company who wants to employ someone who could be very young and poorly educated, or could be older, and there may be a doubt about their ability to cope with modern technology. Under the new unfair dismissal laws, it's hard to get rid of that person. You might want to give that person a try, but if it's difficult to get rid of someone who doesn't perform for whatever reason, here you've got a situation where regulation imposed by the government and supported widely in the community may actually discriminate against not only the young and the poorly educated, but also the aged who are well educated but may have doubts about their ability to adapt.
It's a good question, Jared, and I'm not necessarily proposing regulation as a way to go, except to say that the Age Discrimination Act should be at a similar level to the other pieces of legislation, which is sex discrimination, race discrimination, because, you know, what we do know is that laws are just going to part of a picture. I mean, having appropriate and strong law is important, but really what we're trying to change here is attitudes, and it is about cultural beliefs, not just held in workplaces, but more deeply held in our community, because the beliefs we bring into the workplace about whether or not someone will perform. And I'm not talking about someone who hasn't got the education or skills for the job. I'm talking about someone who has, but because they're over a particular age, we think they're low on energy, too opinionated, whatever the research shows us. Those beliefs that we have more generally in society, we bring them into the workplace and then we hold them very dearly in the workplace, and that's what leads to the exclusion. More generally around the employment laws, I mean, I really can't comment on the industrial relations regime on wrongful dismissal or whatever, but I do think that, you know, older and, as you say, Jared, younger people should have the same rights as everyone else.
Thanks. So,
a few years ago, it seemed to me that with the explosion of whatever we had, the boom times, there was a lack of people for jobs. Employers couldn't find the right people in certain areas, and then older people were actually having an opportunity
to find work. I remember at Heathrow going to a hotel and checking in when we stayed for a night, and there was a woman who looked like she was at least 67 doing the check-in, and it seemed to me that at that time in Britain they couldn't get enough people to do hotel work. They were taking kids from Poland and all of that, and they couldn't speak English very well. So are there areas where older people should be looking to see where there is opportunity rather than just discrimination?
I think that's absolutely right, and the fact is there are some who would argue that actually market forces will solve this problem, because we are moving in once again into a time of skills shortage. We're almost at, you know, under 5% unemployment, and you know that everyone should have the opportunity, and maybe that will have some impact. I suppose my argument would be that if we don't change the fundamental views that we have about older people, that will, you know, skills shortage may help a bit, but it's never going to give older people equality in workplaces that they deserve and that they should have and that they've had all their life up until then. And I mean, just when many of us think we're becoming, you know, more valuable to the workplace, we're suddenly told, well, no, that's not necessarily the case. So I absolutely take your point. Skills shortage will have some impact. Will it totally combat it? I don't think it will.
Thank you very much for your talk. Sorry, that's a bit loud, is it? Thank you very much for your talk. I found it not only enlightening but inspirational. I was wondering if the Commission has looked at what I consider is age discrimination in the area of superannuation. Well, people are working to longer these days than they used to, and now can no longer contribute beyond age 75 to their superannuation and various other things that I consider are discriminatory.
Yeah.
Could you tell me what the Commission has looked at there?
Yeah, no, it's a really great point, and that's exactly where our audit of laws is directed. You've raised a good one, superannuation. Why do we need any cap on employer-funded superannuation? Surely, if you meet the self-employed, you meet the workability test, that should be enough. The other area is workers' compensation. It cuts out at 65. But if eligibility for age pension doesn't come in till 67, how does that work? So we are working with the government to suggest strongly that we should start to review all the different laws, starting with employment laws, to identify those laws that have an age cap, like superannuation, like the other ones, and then start to ask, well, is there a good public policy reason for that age cap? Now, there are in some areas, say at the age you can drink, the age you can get a driver's licence, the age you can watch an R-rated movie. I mean, we have them as a society because we take a view that, you know, we're protecting vulnerable people or whatever it is. There's a good public policy reason for those age limits. But in the other areas, there absolutely isn't. And at the minute, superannuation is exempted. The whole of taxation, insurance, superannuation is exempted from the Age Discrimination Act. So we can't actually, in terms of bringing complaints, they're excluded from or exempted from the Act. All those areas are exempted. So that's why we need an audit of laws. And I think, you know, the government's recognising that. So I think we will see movement on that. Watch this space.
Now, we've got plenty of time. Could you hop in at the microphone so I don't walk in front of the camera? Can I get the microphone up here? I'll get Dirty Craig to hear it. We've got plenty of time, so... Yeah.
Thanks, Elizabeth. It's all very positive, and there's actually a need, an economic need for people to work longer. But if you have a look at what's happening in Europe, the opposite is happening. You're having riots because... and trying to lift the working age. I'm just wondering if you could share some thoughts on that in terms of actually culturally, in a global sense, is this something that everyone's really supportive of?
Yeah, well, you're right. And I don't want my thing to be misread to be everyone must work. This is about choice. It's about choice and control, and I put it in a paradigm. Fascinating to see what's happening in Greece now with the IMF saying, well, okay, actually the pension eligibility won't start until whatever age, was it from 52 to 65? I think it went something like that, and that there's huge riots as a part of that. I do think here in Australia, particularly post-GFC, a lot of people, in a sense, they need to work. And they're particularly those that were to be self-funded retirees and have seen their retirement savings absolutely diminish. So there's probably a greater need for people to be able to be in paid work since post-GFC. And I'd ask, you know, if you want to be in paid work but you go into an environment where older workers are not valued, then is that actually a real choice? Probably not. So my nirvana would be for people of all ages to make a choice whether they need, want or can work, and that they be accepted and their skills valued irrespective of their age. And that it's, you know, that this idea of retirement, I mean, some people say it'll just be phased out, that people will move into flexible work, part-time work, and then over a period will transition into other things. And that's one of the things that panel's looking at, that panel that's just been set up, is that transition arrangement as well, which I think is really important.
Thanks for your talk. This is a cross-cutting question that affects your other portfolio. You've been advocating portfolios in other aspects of your work. And do you see a role for that as a benchmarking, as a pushing of your goal, setting a target or a goal, especially if you've got forecast demographically that say, what, 20%+ by 2050, whatever it is, that a proportion of workforces should be comprised of people over the age of 60 or whatever, partially based on the economic imperative to do so?
It's a really good question. I must say I haven't really thought of it in those terms. And, you know, you'd like to think, well, actually, you know, older workers will represent such a good talent pool that you won't need to encourage people. But, you know, you would say that about women as well. So I think, look, we need to look at all possibilities, but I think where we need to start is, yes, we need the strong prevalence data, we need the education campaign, we need to continue to work with the peak bodies, with older Australians themselves, and to understand what's happening, what their experiences are, and then look at maybe refining some different options. And I take your point that a lot of where I see the age discrimination movement is in a very embryonic stage. Sex discrimination's up here, but there's a lot that we can learn from the two movements, I think. And, I mean, that's one of the great things. Flexible work, for example. That's fantastic for older workers who want to transition. It's also worked so well for mums and dads on parental leave. So there's a lot of cross-learning.
There's a question there then behind you. Do you want to ask a question? Yeah, and then behind you. Okay.
I'm aware in a number of states of trade associations which are working extremely hard to overcome prejudices in younger people. In terms of joining the workforce in those industries. And they're out there working with the TAFEs of this world and other organizations and with private consultants to promote their industries to potential younger people. Mm. It seems to me that from what we've heard tonight, that there's a gaping opportunity there for the same thing to be done for the aging population to overcome the prejudices which you've outlined in some of your cases. Is anything of that kind happening in Australia?
It's a really great point, and I know TAFE are doing some excellent work there. The only thing that comes close to that is this charter that a number of employers have signed on to, and that is directed at lifting their recruitment of older workers in specific areas. So that's one of the things, and to the extent that they've signed on to that charter, then they need the strategies in place to actually deliver on those things. So that's really the only thing that I can think of. But you're absolutely right. If you were looking at, you know, talented, untapped pools of, you know, skills, you'd be well served to look at older people, particularly those who have not chosen to leave work but have self-selected out for all the reasons that we talked about tonight.
Would that be part of the Commission's brief to be out there in the community presenting the benefits of hiring more, presenting the negatives of being
Just repeat that briefly, but then we've got to move on.
We've got
a lot of people.
Okay, all right. One thing I'd say on that, look, the convention actually gives us a great opportunity to get round the community and to talk about those types of things. As to what the future Age Discrimination Commissioner does, I can't bind him or her, but I do think it's an area which is important. Yeah.
Yes.
Just a little diversion from what you've been talking about. Yeah. It's to do with age discrimination as well. We had the question with Piers Ackerman on Sunday on the Barry Cassidy show, talking about the Dame Elizabeth Murdoch being too old to have an opinion. And I think this is relevant to what we're talking about in the workforce, that the older people who want to go and work in the workforce, the younger generation, are sort of saying they're not relevant because they're too old. Mm. Now, Piers Ackerman is saying she's too old, her opinion is not valid, it's not valuable, it's not worthwhile. How does that fit in with the way we feel about the older generation, those people who do have opinions and valuable knowledge that they can pass on to the younger generation, my generation indeed?
You're right. Well, it plays into the classic stereotype there. And people talk to me about it. They say as we get older, we become invisible. People, we might speak, but people don't hear us anymore. And I think she was actually breaking that stereotype by actually speaking out strongly about something she believed in, which, as I understand, was climate change there. And that's what led to those comments. But you're right. We need to look at people based on their own individual capabilities, merit, you know, characteristics. We can't say everyone over the age of 100's, you know, has no opinion. Well, no, that's not right. It's just like people say to me, oh, women over the age of 45, the research very strongly speaks to the fact that women over the age of 45 in paid work are quite, as a group, discriminated against. When you look at what that's about, it's they're too opinionated. Well, you know what? Some are, some aren't. Some 18-year-olds are opinionated, some aren't. That's my point. So, yeah.
Liz.
I kind of got that in a way myself.
Liz, Sue Henry from Council on Ageing. Thank you for the last 3 years and the work you've done. It's been fabulous to have you in the portfolio and with responsibility. I did happen to have a conversation with Piers this morning. I upset him yesterday by putting out a press release after my conversation on Radio National this morning about trying to disaggregate age and capacity.
Mm.
And it's nothing to do with age. Mm. However, what I'm interested in is when you and I and all of us here can be in the street on the social movement, what is going to start that? Where do we actually start this campaign?
The more I think about it, Sue, and you'll probably have better ideas than me on this, I think we started in our own families. I really think we started in our own families, our own spheres of influence, and we work out from there. And I've just seen the impact in my own family of Dad now, and my father's 81, just, you know, pointing out to each of us, his three daughters, you know what, that's an age-based stereotype. Just need to do it once or twice, and that starts to, you know, that starts to gel. And I think if we all worked in our own sphere of influence to do that, then that would start to build. And then, of course, we'd lift the advocacy and we've got great peak bodies who would start to take the message, and we'd have the International Convention on the Rights of Older People. And all those things are tools, but I think where do you start? You start with yourself, and then you start with your immediate family and you move out from there. I'm happy to rent my dad out if anyone. he's travelling the world.
He's one of our members of long standing. You
know. He's travelling the world. He's not playing any
stage. And I just like to say just that Ingmar Bergman, the great Swedish film director, particularly before he died, or not long before he died, he said that we should actually start talking about getting old and being old and age and things like that. And so then the talk today has been very good about discussing it, about bringing it to a wider consciousness. And one of the things that I think is a part of that is the idea of that, even that term, the baby boomer. I think that's a pejorative or discriminatory type tag.
Mm.
And it seems to, I don't know if you would consider that a bad term, but what is your view on
I mean, I'm not in favour of any generational labelling. I understand why people use it, why the media use it. It's a shorthand way of saying, well, this is a person who grew up in this socio-economic and political environment. And maybe it's useful to understand that. But we've actually taken generational labelling one step further, and we say, look, not only did you grow up with this economic and political social background, but also we're ascribing these wholesale characteristics to you. You're too opinionated, you're low in energy, you don't get technology. Well, you know, some will, some won't. But to ascribe it to a whole group based on a generational label, I think is very unhelpful. And baby boomers won, veterans even worse, some of the things that are ascribed. And Gen Y, bad as well, that they're all self-promoting upstarts who won't stay in your job and whatever. Some will be, some won't. So I'm not in favour of it, generally. I try not to use it myself, except in my speech.
Which countries of the world do you consider as benchmarks in this area, and what are the drivers for that
observation?
So the question is, which country in the world do you consider the best benchmarks, and what are the drivers?
Mm. Okay. It's a very good question. I haven't done directed research on the internet, you know, to look at internationally which countries are doing it well, but I would surmise that it'd be those countries that believe in equality more generally. So you'd be looking at the Scandinavian countries, for example. I think, you know, you go to the US or even the UK, and probably a good indicator is, you know, how many anti-aging products are they selling? Is aging, you know, a negative story? Because that's a problem. And I think that's why people are less prepared to talk out on this issue. Because if I associate with ageing, it's a message of negativity and decline, and we need to really turn that round, because there's so much that's wonderful about ageing and the getting of wisdom, all those things. But in our culture, it's youth that is that's admired, that's, you know, and the anti-aging products speak to that. So, but to answer your question, and I have to say it's not on the basis of any empirical research, but I would say it would be in the Scandinavian countries. Yep, exactly. Or
the
even
question was, what about Asian countries?
Yeah, and I think that's right. Or even in Indigenous cultures. I mean, our own, we can look here to our own Indigenous peoples. Yep, absolutely.
Let's comment here.
Yeah. As part of the conversation you invited, may I refer to a very mature worker who turned 84 last week, who some 11 years ago, he was a consultant physician who had a teaching hospital appointment as a visiting medical officer.
Mm.
And a month or so before his 65th birthday, he applied, as was required at the time, for reappointment, for a 5-year reappointment.
Mm.
And he received a reappointment which extended to 1 month in his then birthday. Now, it so happened this consultant physician in another incarnation was one of the three members of the Anti-Discrimination Board of New South Wales, who happened to have had some input into the age discrimination legislation which had just become valid. He therefore thought this was not the right thing to be done. The Health Commission at the time was of the opinion that they were exempt from the legislation.
Mm.
However, this physician decided to challenge this, and the matter went before the Equal Opportunity Tribunal. It took about 3 years before it finally was held, and in the meantime, his appointment was verified and continued in his position. When it came to the hearing for the Equal Opportunity Tribunal, by that time he decided that he really didn't need to be represented by a solicitor. He thought he knew what it was all about, and he decided he didn't represent himself. So he turned up and therefore decided at the tribunal to sit in the row set aside for solicitors representing applicants and respondents. And the young lady who sat next to him said, "I represent the Health Commission. Who do you represent?" And he said, "Well, I represent the applicant, the doctor." And she said, "Well, what are your instructions? Because I've been given no instructions." And he then pointed out that he had instructions, and he represented himself. And within 5 minutes, the Equal Opportunity Tribunal ruled that the dismissal was not in accordance with the law, and he continued in his appointment. So he continued his appointment for about another 10 years until he was satisfied the hospital was going to employ a younger man. Subsequently, he was appointed recently for the third 3-year term to the Equal to the to the Administrative Decisions Tribunal of the New South Wales Government. And very recently, the judge, the district court judge, who had sat with the Equal Opportunity Tribunal and delivered the judgment in his favour, he became a judicial member of that tribunal. And very recently, the doctor in question had the delightful experience to sit in conjunction with that judge on a number of hearings before the tribunal. I shared the pleasure because the doctor in question is myself.
Congratulations, and thank you very much for sharing that.
We won't have a response as long as the comment, but it was an interesting comment. So I think Andy's right down the back. Oh, somewhere here. Sorry. Okay, miss. Yeah. Right down. Let's start and see how we go. Wait a minute.
I think it can be quite useful to think in terms of generational groups, because that's the way in which we can understand how others think of us.
Yeah.
And particularly if you look at the work that's being done, a lot of articles, there's an article in the Financial Review today, how Generation Y think of themselves. And if you're trying to work Generation Y with a baby boomer, it's good to know that people think differently, and there are very clear gaps in differences in the way people think. So I think they can be used to advantage rather than as an old person. I use them to advantage or try to.
Mm. And you're absolutely right. It tells us what we're dealing with and some of the stereotypes that we need to combat. So I take your point on that. Yeah.
So we're getting close to the end. If I missed anyone? So just how do you wind up what you're currently doing with age discrimination? When you hand over, what are you going to hand over, and how does your life change after the appointment of the Age Discrimination Commissioner?
Well, the government's going through a process. They did advertise for expressions of interest, and we're just waiting to hear. I mean, as I said, the bill received royal assent yesterday, so, you know, there is now, or the bill's... The legislation has now set up the Office of the Age Discrimination Commissioner. So that's a positive step. So, yeah, we're just waiting for the announcement. And at that point, you know, someone will come on board. Of course, I'll be working initially to brief them and whatever, and it depends who is appointed, I suppose, as to the particular direction. But I do think this issue of older, because of course age discrimination is across any age, it's about young people as well, but if you look at where the pressure points for government are at the minute, this is definitely one. In relation to what I'll be doing, I've been appointed to run a review into the Australian Defence Force, looking at the treatment of women. You will probably never see me again. That will be such a long-running thing. So don't worry, Jared, I've got lots to do. But I will absolutely miss this area. I hope to stay engaged in it. It's been terrific. It's been terrific working with my commissioners, also at the Australian Human Rights Commission, and my wonderful staff who are here with me tonight. And I want to particularly acknowledge Priya Sarachandran. She knows more about age discrimination than almost anyone in Australia, so it's terrific to have been able to work with her and the good team that I have. And thank you very much, Jared, for inviting me along again.
Pleasure. Thanks, Elizabeth. So I'll be very brief. Thanks to Millicent again for the use of this great facility this evening. Elizabeth Broderick is a terrific communicator, and we saw that again tonight. She's been here quite a few times before. I'm sure she'll be at the Sydney Institute again sometime in the future. But tonight, for a very impressive take on a very important and increasingly discussed issue, we're very grateful you could come along and give us this important paper, which it's good to see Channel 648 here on Foxtel and Austar, and this talk will be on our podcast and will be published when Anne puts out the Sydney papers online. So for tonight, Elizabeth, congratulations and all the best for the future. Well done. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.